and welcome to the Clever Techs podcast, Creating Useful People. I'm Jodie Cook, and today I'm joined by Phil Jupitus. Phil is a stand-up and an improv comedian. He's also an actor, a performance poet, a cartoonist, and a podcaster. Phil was a team captain on the BBC Two show Never Mind the Buzzcocks for 19 years. He regularly appears on other panel shows, including QI, and within the last month, you've probably seen him on Dave. Phil, a huge welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jodie Tarr. Cheers.
So first question, when you were younger, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I remember not having a particularly clear sense of that when I was a kid. I mean, when I was little, there was nothing pulling me particularly. I remember my mum used to be quite insistent about saying that I should join the Merchant Navy so I could see the world. Which, okay, fair enough. You know, your parents have aspirations for you. I think it's her brother. My Uncle Gerald would have been in the Merchant Navy, and I think she thought that somehow that would be a good thing for me. I've never pressed her on this, but that was never going to happen. And then when I got to school and was hanging around some subjects a bit more, the first thing I can remember fancying my chances at in terms of something that I'd enjoy was working for the Met Office. I was quite interested in weather. But then when you actually go to a careers seminar and you chat to people that know about these things, any weather people listening will know that you need a lot of maths and a lot of science to work at the Met Office. And I wasn't very good at either. I just like weather. So that was never going to happen either. So that was the first thing I quite fancied. And then once I investigated, I realized it would not happen. And so that was the only ambition I ever had, and I let it go fairly quickly.
So I was doing some reading and read that at age 14, your mom said you wanted to be the manager of a co-op.
Now, this is a bit later than that. I think she's got her timings wrong. When I left school and I realised the weatherman thing wouldn't happen, so I thought I could just get a job to just to do. I just thought, right, you do a job, you earn money, it facilitates doing other things. And so I just, as a kid, just thought, right, then work somewhere nearby that you don't have to go too far and then live an external life. So I remember as a kid thinking, well, yeah, just get a local job somewhere. No fuss, no nonsense. That was, yeah, I did say that to her. Because it's the joke that they always, once in a while, they throw at me. I remember after they saw me in Hairspray, I remember my dad saying to me, co-op manager, when he'd seen me on stage in a red sequin dress dancing. Co-op manager, is it?
When did comedy first start coming into your life?
Yeah, what, like as a fan?
As a fan, and maybe, when did you first start thinking, like, oh, wow, this could be a career?
I became sort of aware of comedy because I get asked this a bit, and so you try to really get down to the nut of it, really. I remember when I was little, when I was single figures, I remember the first person who I thought was funny in terms of he does funny things that amuse me and I like what he does. And again, there's this particular generation of your listeners I'm speaking to right now, and this will mean very little to your millennials, is a chap called Brian Kent. He was one of the presenters on a kids show called Play School and then subsequently Play Away. And he was absolutely the off-kilter one. He was the one that was doing stuff for the kids but had an eye on the fact that the parents were watching as well. So he was the first, I would say, comedian who I became aware of, that you could have a slightly different attitude to things, that you could be funny in a kind of off-the-radar way in your manner and your bearing, and there could be a twinkle in your eye where you're referring to something else. So I remember liking him a lot when I was a kid. And then some of comedy influences when I was little were him, Warner Brothers and MGM cartoons. So things like that were produced by directors like Chuck Jones and Tex Avery and Friz Freleng. Just the pace of American cartoons. I found American comedy quite exotic because most American comedy that emerged in the 20th century was ostensibly Jewish comedy. And certainly a lot of the writers and animators that worked at Warner Brothers, and certainly the Marx Brothers and people like that, you know, it was something other to me. It was something different. And so I remember responding to that as a child. And then, of course, my stepfather would make me listen to The Goons whenever it was repeated on Radio 4 when we lived out in the Latchingdon in Essex. I remember listening to The Goons as a kid. And again, not really getting it, but there was nothing to get. It was just madness. It was just weirdness. I liked Asterix books when I was a kid. So my comedy was coming at me from a lot of different directions. It was red. It was audio. It was cartoons, which were very sort of brightly coloured and on telly, very loud and fast. And it was this guy, Brian Cant. So there were various different sources of comedy to me as a child. And as I got older, it sort of became more refined. And I think you start, as you get older and you get a circle of friends, you start to get into what they're into. And so at junior school, so we're talking late 60s, early 70s, was when Monty Python started. And that was something that my mate's big brothers were watching. And subsequently, that would kind of rub off on us younger ones. And so I remember in the 70s getting into Monty Python as a child, yeah.
Do you remember when you started channeling these shows and these people yourself? Like, do you remember when it affected your behaviour?
When I was at school, when we used to do drama, me and my mates used to do sort of Python knockoff sketches. We used to rip off that non-linear madcap, you can say or do anything style. And so that was in second and third year at junior school. We used to do that. I was already kind of earmarked by teachers as being, oh, that kid that can do anything in dramas. He's a bit sort of loose and show-offy, and so we can use him to do things. So I remember one of the first gigs that I got at school was being like the MC of an evening of songs from the musical Oliver. So that would have been 1969 or 1970 that, yeah, they kind of went, you can introduce the songs. And so I was like, oh, okay, all right, yeah. And that was the first time I remember being on my own in front of people. Performing, yeah.
And so at the time, did you feel comfortable in that role?
Yeah, wasn't a bother. So I just used to do voices when I was a kid. I used to do loads of different voices. And when I say that now, it's because it's what I do for a living. I don't see it as anything. But if I thought of an eight-year-old now, if I met an eight-year-old and he did different accents, I think it was hilarious. So I suppose I never understood why they picked me. But now when I put myself in their position, I can go, all right, yeah, okay. Trappy show-off kids are really useful to teachers because it just takes a bit of the weight off them responsibility-wise.
Apart from in drama and lessons where you could be outspoken, what were you like at school academically?
Right, at little school, I really loved it. I really enjoyed everything. I loved poetry. I loved English. I loved reading. I loved art. I loved history. I loved all of it. And then like many, many, many people, you get to big school, and it is just crushed out of you by sheer weight of numbers and the fact that kids, when they move into their teens, become feral and start picking on each other. And that was when I lost interest in school because the teachers, because they're dealing with classes of 30 kids that are chatting back to them, that are giving them trouble, you don't get the same attention at big school that you do at little school. And I think that that is a problem in education. Certainly there must have been some research on and some talk about, but the fact that you take a kid who's thriving and doing really, really well in a number of subjects who over the space of 6 months turns into an idiot, that's not right. That is not right. But it's just, you know, you move into an environment where you don't thrive and suddenly, you know, you were the big fish in the small pond and then that circumstance becomes reversed. And I'm sure it's a very familiar story to people that are listening, that transition to big school. Some people, it's the making of them. Suddenly, they move into an environment where they're not in one classroom all day. They're moving from place to place. They've got more of a sense of they find different tribes, different groups that they can hang around with. You know, whereas if you were just a loudmouth kid that was a social alpha at little school, that will be taken away from you. After the summer holidays, that's going now. Say goodbye to that life. You don't have that life anymore. So, yeah, that happened to me. So I was a washout at school, rubbish. I didn't like lessons. Unless a teacher would engage with me as an equal, frankly, excuse my language, but I had no time for teachers, absolutely no time at all, if they weren't interested in me. And many teachers at a secondary level are not that interested in their pupils.
Do you remember at that time not wanting to go to school each day?
Well, I kind of had no choice because my mum realised I was washing out at the school that I was at. So she sent me to boarding school because she was technically a single parent. So you could get hardship case grants to send kids to schools. And my aunt had her, my cousins were at a school. And my aunt said to my mum, well, you could probably apply and get Philip in. And so I went to a boarding school and that was just awful. That was four terrible, terrible, horrible years.
Did you leave when you were 16 or 16, 18?
Yeah, I couldn't get out quick enough.
What did you do after that?
Then I went to sixth form college and I went there because there were girls. And I got a couple more O-levels to add to the five that I gained at school. I got my English O-level a year early. And that was only because I had a brilliant English teacher called Phil Taylor who did indulge me and did see that I was someone that didn't fit. I was a social misfit at school. I had a few mates, but I didn't fit any group. I wasn't hip. My mum cut my hair. I just didn't fit. I wasn't bothered by trends and things. And there was just, I just remember there being a very clear moment where everyone around me just got big and hard and started conforming to social norms. And I was still, what, can't we have a laugh? And they were, no, they didn't want to know. So, you know, again, that's what I'm not really friends with anybody I was at that school with. I think I've got two mates who I'm still friends with from that time. And a couple of other people I occasionally bump into. But no, I didn't make any life friends at school. No.
So when you were around that age, the kind of big school age, what were your hobbies? What did you like doing when you weren't studying?
I love music. And it's because, of course, the older boys at school were listening to stuff. And with it being a school where there were boys from London, so punk hit me quite early. Because the lads had bigger brothers and the lads were from London and London was where punk was happening. And so I just remember there being a lot of stuff available. And then because someone told me that he played good music, I started listening to John Peel when I was about 14, 15. And that was a sort of a gateway to new music. And yeah, music was a bit of a refuge for me. I loved it. I liked reading. I used to sail at school a bit. That was nice because you got out on the water and there was no one around you. I wasn't a sporty kid at all, so that wasn't really an option for me.
So music, reading and sailing in order to get away from the horrible kids at school.
No, you know what? The way that I'm phrasing it, they weren't horrible. They were really lovely blokes, but it was that I didn't fit. It wasn't that they were horrible. It was that I felt out of place. And so I isolated myself quite a bit. But you go into Ipswich, go to the pictures. You know, I remember going to see Close Encounters and Jaws. I remember my favourite trip to the pictures was going to see, I went to see a double bill of Monty Python and the Holy Grail with Blazing Saddles. So that's two of the most informative comedy films I ever saw in my life, and I saw them in a double bill. So on the same day, your idea of how comedy works got completely realigned when you were 14. You know, it was amazing. It was a great day.
When we first met a couple of years ago, it was for the Radio 4 show that you were hosting called Being Bored, The Importance of Doing Nothing. And I remember you talking about meeting your mates like in a car park and kicking a can around or something like that. How much of a role did boredom play in your life?
We're talking about me. If you looked at a 15-year-old boy now, and the options that he had open to him in terms of filling his time. The big difference is the gadget. A 15-year-old boy would have his face buried in a phone and would be constantly communicating with. So straight away, he's created a social network of people who he can interact with at any time that he wants. Plus, there's all the various distractions on the phone, be they game-wise, be they social media wise, be they, and let's not be about the bush, pornography wise, you know. So this is, I just had my face buried in the gadget now, you know, whereas then you read a book and you pick up the book and you'd be aware that you were doing something to stop being bored. And so that would make you hate it. And I remember that it didn't matter what you did. When you were bored, you were bored. And it didn't matter what you tried to do, which is why you would end up going to an adult and saying, I'm bored, because you wanted them to fill your time with something. And boredom was very much predicated on money. So if you had money, you could do something to not be bored. You could take a train into London. You could go to the pictures. You could go shopping. You could do things. You go to Basildon and go to Godfrey's Records and look at records that you couldn't afford to buy. But it's, you know, it's better to go and look at stuff you can't afford, even if you haven't got the money for it, just to be doing something. So quite often, because I didn't have I didn't get a job or anything, that's always what would happen, is when you'd say I'm bored, which was code for give me money, and then they wouldn't give you money. My mum would never cave into that, and so she'd go, well, then get a job then. And I'm like, but you didn't have the first idea of how you went about getting a job. I think it's like, which seems, I mean, dumb, but it's like you think about, well, what would I be happy doing? And it's like, can't deliver newspapers, haven't got a bike, you know, and I go through the things in my head. Do I want to work as a Saturday boy in a shop? No, I don't, you know. And it was only once I got a girlfriend and I was older that whole get a job so you've got money, because I had a need, which was I thought that to keep the girlfriend interested, I'd have to be able to do things with her. That was when I went and got a job. That was the impetus to make me go out and do something, was when I was 17, yeah, and had a girlfriend finally, yeah.
What was your first job?
So, wait a minute. So when I was 15, I painted a steamroller.
Okay.
It was green. No, it was yellow and I painted it green. So that we spent a week doing that. So that's scraping it down, priming it, and then painting it. That was a job that we had. I got 30 quid for doing that, which for a week's work in the late 70s was a king's ransom.
How did you get that? Was it just a friend who said?
Friend of my dad's, yeah, because my stepdad worked in the building trade. He was a surveyor, so he knew people that ran companies and things. And, yeah, I think, to be honest, it was more a case of we want him out of the house with his constant moaning about being bored. me and my mate Mark painted a steamroller.
So when you were painting the steamroller, were you very aware that it was just a week, or did you ever think, oh, I could do this all the time?
No, yeah, it was always just a temporary thing. I was just thinking about once I got the money.
What did you do? What did you do with 30 quid?
I think I bought some unfashionable jeans and some records. I would have bought records and a pair of jeans and maybe a t-shirt with a slogan on it.
That sounds perfect, living the dream.
That's idyllic, doesn't it?
Yeah. So then painting the steamroller, and then what was next?
So that I did that in the summer when I was at school. I think I must have gone back to school and then didn't know what to do, didn't know how to do it. And then I went to, well, sixth form college, and then I met the girlfriend, and then I got a job. I became a Saturday boy at Tesco's Wines and Spirits. So I got a Saturday job in Tesco's, which I did for about a year and a half, I think.
I've got that. You started working in a job centre in 1984.
Yeah, it was once I left college. So I left sixth form college. All my mates had got A-levels. So they all went to university. Whereas I, because I had no guidance or idea of what to do, because I didn't have any ambition. If you've got no ambition with what you want to do, then you can't pick subjects that will channel you in a particular direction. So you're just picking subjects on a whim. And so I just chose all the wrong things. Subsequently, didn't really get anywhere along at all. I dropped out of A-level geography because I was just crap at it. I just picked geography because I liked it. I did human biology and got a U. I picked Russian and got a U. And again, I was just picking things for something to do. I did pottery as a general study. I did O to A level economics, which was hilarious because the guy was teaching O A level economics. And at the end of the first year, you do the O level. And then at the end of the second year, you do the A level. And me and my mate were the only ones that passed the O level in the class because our girlfriends had O level notes on economics. So just before the exam, we spent 2 weeks reading actual O-level economics notes, which were much more easy than the guy trying to teach us about all the other stuff.
Nice.
O-level in economics without really knowing anything about it. It was great. And then I got a B in geography. It's the only B I've ever got, which I'm quite proud of, because I was doing O-A-level geography, but then I dropped out afterwards. And so I was at college, but not really at college. I ended up with 7 O-levels. And so as soon as I finished college, I started applying for just office jobs. And I got into the civil service locally in Essex.
Why office jobs? Like what was your thinking behind the jobs that you were applying for at the time?
Well, because it's you look in the paper and it says office, clerical officer, you need 5 O levels. I had 5 O levels. I was a clerical officer. I'm like, well, there we go. That's all we need.
Did you question it then? Did you kind of see it as that's the newspaper ad, that's what I'm qualified for, therefore that's what I'm destined to be?
£1,800 a year, and it was local, and I had the qualifications for it, so let's apply for that. That was it, literally. I can do that, I'll do that. It was that brought me a certain amount of money, which enabled me a certain lifestyle, which was all I needed at the time. I was living with my mum and paying her quite a chunk of change to stay there.
How did this turn into making it, I guess? How did this turn to like making it as a poet and then as a comedian?
So I used to go to gigs and things a lot, and I used to go and see loads and loads of different cultural things, bands, music. I started going to see comedy gigs. I went to see Rowan Atkinson and Lexi Sale in the same year when they did their first. It was just after Rowan's first Edinburgh run with Richard Curtis, and he did a UK tour. And so I saw Rowan Atkinson in Basildon. I saw Lexi Sale in Basildon. I went to see Neil Innes, who used to be part of the Python Lot and in the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band in Basildon. And again, Basildon had this venue called the Towngate Theatre. And I used to go and see people there. And I used to occasionally go to things in London. And I used to go and stay with mates who were at university. And I went to stay with my mate Karen. She lived in a squat in Islington. And I went to stay with her one weekend. Not in that way. She was just a mate. And I went to stay with Karen. We went out on the Friday and got drunk on cider, all the usual. And then she said, oh, tomorrow night we're going to a lesbian party. And I thought, well, there's nothing there for me. There's nothing for me at a lesbian party. And there's stuff there for you, but there's nothing really there for me. You know what? I'll take a rain check on the lesbian party. So I'll find something to do. And I got a copy of City Limits. Was it City Limits? Yeah, City Limits, which was like a listings mag in London. And I had a read. And there was a gig on in Wapping called The Ranter's Revenge, which was an evening of poetry. And it was, at the time, there was a scene of poetry called ranting poetry. And it was a lot of people being very loud and very angry about things. And so I thought, I'll go and see them. And it was a really, really good night. And there were about 14 to 20 acts on. Really, they were barreling through. It was a big night and everybody was on. I saw Benjamin Zephaniah, Jules. It was amazing. Attila the Stockbroker, Seething Wells, Little Dave, Little Brother. I mean, all the ranters at the time were on at this gig, a guy called Swiftnick from Hull. But while I was watching it, and I'm thinking, I don't even do this for a living, and I know that I'm better than half the people on this bill. I know I could write better poetry than half the people on this bill. And I'm like, that didn't even rhyme. The scansion's all wrong on that. That guy doesn't even know how to use a microphone. And I've never used one. And I could see that. And I'm like, well, surely. My thought was, if they can do that, then why can't I? Which is, I imagine, which was a lot of the impetus for punk bands in the 70s was looking at people thinking, well, if he can do that or she can do that, then why can't I? And that was certainly a motivating factor, was looking at people that were doing this. And then I thought, right, well, I'll have a go. And it wasn't that I thought I'd perform even. I just knew I could write better stuff. And I remember I just started writing poetry. But like, and I always had, but I just started writing more and more and more of it. So at the time, my hobbies by then, because my girlfriend had gone off to university, I used to draw a lot. I was a cartoonist. And I was, because I was really fascinated with cartoons, strip cartoons and comics and things. And so I used to draw my own. And I started writing poetry as well. And then after that gig, the guy called Swiftnick, the poet from Hull, I met him on the Tube Strain platform, and he gave me a copy of his fanzine, which is a very rough, homemade, photocopied, terrible little magazine. And I thought, I could do cartoons for this. And so I did some and sent them to him, and he used them.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was, oh my God, I'm in a fanzine. I couldn't believe it. And then I used to do stuff for him for about a year. And then the poet called Attila the Stockbroker saw my stuff in Swiftnick's fanzine. And he said, I'm doing a book and I need illustrations. And I wondered if you'd like to illustrate it for me. And so I went to meet him at a pub in sort of, it was Ladbroke Grove Way, Portobello Road. Can't even remember what the pub's called, the Prince of something. I met him and he said, oh, can I see some of your drawings? And I had my folder with me that had, and I used to carry all my work around with me in a little bag. I used to carry all my stuff around with me, all my drawings, all my poems. And he was looking at the drawings. And then he took out a poem and I went, oh, no, this is just my poetry. He went, no, hang on, let me read it. And he read two poems and he went, right, you can do these tonight. And I went, what? What do you mean, what? And he went, you can get up tonight before me and you can do these. You can support me. And I went, I've never done it before. He went, well, just get up and do it. And so it was Attila the stockbroker, John Bain from Shoreham in Sussex. He is why you're talking to me today. He is why. And so he got me on stage. When I went there, there was no thought that I'd do anything. I just turned up to meet a bloke and he made me get on stage. And this was August of 1983. And so this 35 years ago. And I did it and I got some laughs. And I like that a lot. Because everything that I'd done, all the stuff that I was doing, it was deferred approval. So I'd eventually show things to people. I'd go, oh, yeah, we like that. But it was like ages later, or the cartoons. And I'd go, oh, look at that. I drew that. They go, oh, yeah, that's good. Whereas there was an immediacy to performing that I'd never encountered before. Because you know straight away whether they like you or not. Right away. Immediately. And I'm like, this is good. So that it's like the difference between, I don't know, I assume Maxwell House and crack in terms of the kick that you get, because it's right there, right now. And that was it. And I started writing even more then. And then my next gig, a mate of mine was at Sussex University and he knew a social secretary. And he went, well, we can get you a gig supporting. There's a band on the campus called the Piranhas and you can open for them. And I've still got the contract somewhere because I found it the other when I was moving house in a box of documents. I got paid £20. It was my first professional engagement. That was November of that year of 83 to open for the Piranhas in Sussex at the University of Sussex. Yeah.
And so where was that on a scale of Maxwell House to crack?
That was like me actually being on stage and doing things and doing. I did 25 minutes. And people enjoyed it. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I was supporting the Piranhas, who were a band I'd heard of. And so I was like, I couldn't believe it. I was on with a band who I'd heard of. It was like unreal. And then the next year, the same guy, that gig had gone so well that the social secretary at Sussex got me to support Billy Bragg. And that was kind of a next step along. And then I properly met Attila again, who I already knew and was doing bits and bobs for, and Seething Wells, who was, you know, went on to be a comedy writer for Chris Morris and people like that. And yeah, it was a very, very different vibe. And that was what started me on it. But I was still working in the office, but I was also doing poetry gigs at night. So yeah.
In this story so far, it sounds like you did well at something and then someone else created the break for you after that. Did you feel like that was it?
The way that I appear to have worked is there's never been, I've never had, I'm not like Eddie Izzard. I've spoken to Eddie about process a lot because I've interviewed him 3 times for various things. And that boy knows what he wants to be doing in 5 years. I don't know what I want to be doing next Friday. Anything could happen over the next 5 days. So let's get through today, shall we? And then we'll see what tomorrow brings. That is how I have lived my life, which is not ideal, but it works for me. So I've just remained open to things. And that, you know, you were talking at the beginning, when you said at the beginning, Jody, you read out my CV of things that I have done. That is a disparate and sporadic and happenstance and scattergun approach to a career, but I like it. I think I have a combination of an extreme curiosity about things that I haven't done, and if you couple in with that, a short attention span. So I'll do things like, last year when I finished Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, I've had a bit of a month after I finished the job, And then I remember at the end of the month going, I'm not going to act anymore. I'm done that now. Actually deciding that I don't want to do acting anymore because there's too much in it that I couldn't control. So I won't be doing musicals anymore. I mean, but the thing is, as I say that, I make these edicts to myself. And then something will come along and go, how about this? And then you'll go, oh, yeah, all right. I've got no commitment to the decisions that I make, but I do keep hold of them for a while. So, I definitely decided that I'm going to spend a couple of years just doing stand-up. And I'm halfway through that year now.
It sounds like such an awesome attitude to life to have, especially if you know that you are good at a lot of things and a lot of opportunities will just come to you.
Well, I've done so much interesting stuff. This is it. You know, I've directed pop videos for people. I've done ADR voiceovers for French cartoons and put them into English. I've done a kids' TV show where I played a baddie. I mean, I've been 300 different Welsh ants. I've been I'm the voice of an owl. On Amazon Prime at the minute. I mean, all this stuff comes at you. And it's that, yeah, why not? Appears to have served me quite well over the last 35 years. I'll be honest with you, Jodie.
Well, that's exactly what you responded to my email about asking you to be on this podcast.
The reason that I like doing these and I love doing these sort of things is because I don't think about them. And when I'm interviewed about them, I have to think about them. And so I quite like it because it makes me go, oh, yeah, right. So you do that. That's your process. That's how you work. And it gives me more of a handle on myself when other people talk to me about what I do. But basically, I don't think about it a lot.
This whole, yeah, why not kind of attitude, where did it come from? Like if you go back however many years, did you have like your mom or your stepdad, were they yeah, why not people? Who was the person who showed you that?
They were in the arts. I mean, you know, so stepdad was a draftsman. Well, he's a draftsman. He still does it. And mum's an artist. In fact, my mum has just done some painting work for a new advertising campaign for Berghaus. So my mum is a professional working artist. Today, in fact, on my way to my gig in Basingstoke tonight, I'm going to stop off at Somerset House where one of my mum's pieces of art are on display in London. You know, so my mum's still doing it, even though she didn't do it professionally for like 40 years. Well, longer than that. She used to be a textile designer at Liberty's and then someone there stole designs off her and so she quit. That's I think I might have got that from mum. Once something happens that you don't like, my mum's kind of put that into me, that kind of walk away from it. I think that's that decision about I don't want to do musicals now. The second you don't like something, rather than solve the problem, if solving the problem uses too much of your energy, then don't. Solving a problem, I think, is a negative. It's a positive thing to do to solve a problem, but it's like fixing something. You've got to fix it, and you have to fix it. And my mum would be, no, don't fix it, do something else. And you see, I never thought that before, Jodie, but because you've talked to me today about that, I think that's where I got it from. So I think I very much got the why not. I think that is sort of from her, yeah. And also from the fact that I can't commit to things. And so it's kind of a combination of positivity, but then at the same time, I've been doing the other thing for too long. Why don't I do something else? And I think that's why I like the panel shows, because they are the panel shows. It's like, oh, you did that for a long time. Why did you do Buzzcocks for so long? I'm like, well, why wouldn't you? It's basically those shows. That's one night where you're just with a load of new people and you're getting to know them. And some of them are brilliant and some of them are inspiring and some of them are quiet and some of them are idiots. But you're only with them for 2 hours and then you never have to see any of them again, ever. And then next week, let's do it again. And so it was really good fun. And the thing that kept me there was Noel Fielding. When Noel came into Buzzcocks, suddenly it became a completely different show. It became much more of a laugh. It became sillier. It became more fun, which is how I always – that's what this job is. It's silliness. It is organized silliness comedy. People that get incredibly analytic about it, I think, are missing the point somewhere. And much as I admire people who can craft and write and create and write a show and repeat it every night word for word, I turn up in a town – and I'm like, right, let's be in a good mood. Let's see what I can do for these people. Let's see what can happen tonight. I like the fact that there's an I'm looking for the unquantifiable moment in any night when you're performing. That's what I like, the unpredictability.
So then really, if someone was looking at your CV and they saw Buzzcocks for 19 years, they'd probably have a false sense of your attention span, because it's not really the 19 years that's important. It's actually the whole...
Like, if you look at it, it's like, so Buzzcocks, that's half, they're half an hour. I did 280, so that's 140 hours. That's not a month's work. That's a month. 19 years, 1 month's work. 19 years, 1 month. 19 years. So think of it like that. And yet, because it's on telly, it sort of defines you, which is weird. Because it was just, I just look on that as 280 random nights out.
In 2012, I think it was, I went to Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and there was a free fringe going on. Yeah. And I saw you at the free fringe being Porky the Poet.
Right, yeah.
And so what you opened up with was to say that you knew that, like, you were involved in the Edinburgh Fringe, but you felt like it was really important that the artists who were involved in the Fringe were still doing free Fringe stuff to make comedy more accessible.
Yeah, that's a very naive and utopian view to have, and that is wrong, because, you know, it's not that it's wrong, but it is a bit utopian. But I could afford to do free shows. Not everybody can afford to do free shows, but all I want to do is change the mindset of new comedians. And my thing is if you're a new comedian, treat the Edinburgh Festival like your holiday for the year. You go on holiday, but you're working. So therefore, when you go on holiday, you're willing to spend money that you won't get back because you're on holiday. And look at the Edinburgh Fringe like that. And it's a holiday where you work. And that's how I started looking at the Fringe. And indeed, I was in a luxurious position because I had a job and I had Buzzcocks and things. And so I was able to rent a big house in Newtown and invite my kids and tell them they can invite all their friends to stay. And we could invite friends from Essex to come up and stay with us if they wanted to see the Fringe for a few days. And we just became like an open house, and people would come and go all the time. And that was a great way of doing the Fringe. And I love doing those free shows. I can't see a time where I won't do free shows at the Edinburgh Fringe. I absolutely love it. It makes it feel more like a festival.
How do kind of comedians coming up and through now, how are they different to that mindset?
I just think that now when they go to Edinburgh, they see it as a stepping stone towards the next point of their career. And to some it can be, but the Edinburgh show will be the stepping point to the next part of your career. And it's going to be that to maybe 1% of the people at Edinburgh, maybe 1%, maybe. The Edinburgh Festival, you're there to do the Edinburgh Festival, I think. If your mindset is, I want to do Edinburgh and have a laugh in Edinburgh and doing Edinburgh, then you'll enjoy that. But if you go to Edinburgh thinking, I'm going to do Edinburgh so I can get on Mock the Week, then you're going to die on your ass. I think that's definitely it. It's the attitude that you go to it with. And I think that it's important for people to just have a slightly different attitude to it. I mean, and the thing is I'm saying all this to you, Jodie, and I'm fully aware now that there are people listening going, well, that's not right, and that didn't work for me, and what about so-and-so? Well, that's all fine, and that's all well and good, but you've got to find a way of doing something that will work for you, you know. All right, I know some acts are in the early days of Edinburgh, in the late 80s and early 90s, and I'm not going to say the company they work for, but I got a mate I spoke to recently, and he did a show at the Fringe in the late 1980s. It was a late night show. It had an audience of about 150 people, and it sold out every night. And at the end of his run, he owed the people 60 quid who put that gig on. So, you know, that's why I think the free Fringe, where you look after yourself, you find a venue, and you've got to get your audience in. You've got to entertain them, and you've got to rattle a bucket at them. That's a good kind of way to find out if you want to do it some more, I think. You know, if you want to take the next step and then speak to people that can help you put a show on and can polish it up a bit and can give you some more advice and maybe get you a PR on it. If you want to do it the industry way, then why not? Why not? You know, it can be fabulous. But at the same time, I think it's good that you can do it in a very under the radar way as well.
And it feels like you've been more in control of it.
Well, you very much are. Certainly when I do my free shows, that is very much the vibe that I have, is that, yeah, is that I'm doing it. I've got a lovely lad called Christian who does leafleting for me. On top of the people, you know, the office have people leafleting for me, but I get postcards made. I've got a young lad called Christian who did some leafleting for me this year. He's a really lovely boy. The shows were always full, you know. I did a stand-up show at Bannerman's this year that we were turning about 20, 30 people away every day. You know, it was great fun. Perfect size room for me. You know, it holds 75 people and that's it. You know, me every morning at lunchtime, 75 people, always full. It's great.
We've talked about your mum a little bit. So what are her kind of thoughts on the career path that you've chosen? Like what were they back then when you first started out?
She's very much a do whatever you want, whatever makes you happy sort of person, my mum. I know that she preferred it when I did musicals and she came to see musicals and things. I know she really liked that because she understood musicals. She could see me doing something she understood. Whereas I get the feeling that she never really got the poetry and the opening for bands and the stand-up. I get the feeling she didn't really have a handle on that. You know, that was something a little more sort of foreign to her. But musicals, it's me in a dress singing You Can't Stop the Beat in the West End. She understood that. And then when she came to see me in The Producers and she came to see me in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, she got that. She understood how that worked. You know, that's me in a costume singing songs. She understands that branch of showbiz. But I always got the feeling that with my side of things, with the more alternative culture side of things, she was a little bit, well, what is that? And why do people like that? And the same, you know, I'd take it a QI. You know, sometimes I'd take it a recordings of QI. And she, and again, even then, you know, and what? And people just, so you just, he asks you questions and what? You just make up the answers. All right? And she, I just think she had more of a handle on traditional showbiz rather than what I do. So, but she, the thing is, I live in Scotland now. I paid for the house. That's it. You know, once it, all you need to do to keep your mum at me is tell her that you've got a roof over your head. And then that's fine. They just, parents just want their kids to be rooted somewhere and safe, and that's all they want. And then other than that, do what you want. As long as you're not hurting people or being a dick, then do what you like. And so I think she's quite happy with the way things have gone for me, particularly as I had no sense of what to do and no, you know, for a kid that said he wanted to manage a co-op and lay low, I've not really done that, have I? And so she likes it when she, you know, if she sees me on things, you know, I was on Zoe Ball's show the other morning and I chatted about my mum doing a painting for me. And she's had people ask her for her autograph off the back of me mentioning her on telly. And the other thing as well is she's just done this bit of artwork for this advertising campaign for Berghaus. My mum's got her own creative life as well now. And I seem to remember once when she was a little girl, she wanted to be a singer, my mum. But just it never happened for her. And I think she's just happy that I didn't know what I wanted to do, but it happened for me.
So how are you a similar or a different parent to what your mum was?
I have more money. I have more resources than my mum had, you know, because she raised me on her own. And then before she hooked up with my stepdad. How am I different? I don't know, really. It's, you know, I mean, the thing is you raise your kids to be independent and then tragically they are. So I've got a daughter in America. She emigrated. So that's a bit tough. And I've got another daughter who lives in the Midlands. But they really do their own thing. They're very individualistic. And what they've got from me is the sense that you can kind of do whatever you want. Well, it's early days for them, for God's sake. They're not even, you know, they've still got time to kind of find their way properly, I think. They've still got their life in front of them. So, yeah. I think I've served them all right. And that's it. I always saw that your job as a parent, it's not to steer them and it's not necessarily to teach them other than teaching them not to be dicks. Your job as a parent is safety net. You catch them when they're little. You physically catch them when they're little and they fall over. And then when they're teenagers and they start to form relationships and they start to fall in love and things like that, you emotionally catch them when they're at their low ebbs. And then when they leave home, you financially catch them. And that's the bit that never stops. you are the financial safety net as well. And so that's all I'm there for, is to catch them.
So you said raising them to be independent. Is that a conscious choice? Like, do you do certain things in order to raise them to be independent?
No, the thing you have to understand that their mother did all the their mother did all that. I was just the bank. It was their mother who made sure that they went to university, that they did their A levels. They both got firsts. Those girls are bright. And that's the thing, is I'm the one now in the family who didn't go to university, but I've got two doctorates.
Yeah, you have. I saw that. I saw a picture of you in your robes and your gown.
I'm two separate doctors, Jodie.
So you mentioned the safety net. Are there any lessons that you are passing on to your kids apart from just being there?
No, it's because to have lessons, you'd have to have a philosophy, or you'd have to have a plan, and then you'd have to explain how the plan works to them. My baseline for my kids as I was raising them was that I'd like them to be inclusive, bright, tolerant, and not racist. That was how I wanted my children to be, and they are those things. So job done.
Winner, winner. Yeah. Phil, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you wanted me to ask you?
My favourite cheese is Blacksticks Blue. It's a great cheese.
Favourite pizza topping?
Well, it depends where I am. But actually, the thing is with pizza is, because it is a very basic food, you have to go for the most basic version of it. So the Neapolitan pizza, if you are going to a new pizza place, I would heartily advocate that you have a thin-based Neapolitan pizza and you take one bite. And if you don't like that, then leave that place and never go there again. Because that's like the basis of all pizza, is the plain Neapolitan. And if you can't, the thing is, the Mark, I tell you what, is there's an amazing place that I go to in Edinburgh, which is called Eden's Kitchen, which is in Broughton Street. And those lads are, I think they're Turkish. And they do a pizza there, and they also do flatbread. And their flatbread is delicious and tasty without any dip at all. It's soft, it's warm, it's got texture, it's got flavour, and that's it. Simple foods should be had without any adulteration whatsoever. So that's why, so pizza toppings. I've done 5 minutes on pizza toppings. This is the sort of bloke you're dealing with.
That's fine. It's absolutely fine.
The most basic. But, you know, that said, I do like... what is the one? Is it the Napa pizza? Napoli? Is it? No, so the Napoli's the plain one. What is the one which is anchovies and olives?
I was going to say capricciosa, but I think that's got an egg on it as well.
Yeah, that's a different one. So just anchovies and olives, because okay. That's the first pizza I remember eating as a kid. And so that's very salty. Oh, that's a salty pizza. But yeah, the plainest, most simple pizza is the best thing.
I think that's just good sound advice for life. Just keep it simple. And if it doesn't... Yeah. If it doesn't work out, take one bite and then leave and never return.
There's so much choice these days, isn't there? There's so much bloody choice. But I think it's if you go back to basics. You must not be frightened to go back to the basics. Yeah, that's how I see things.
Phil, thank you so much for joining me and for entertaining us this morning.
No, really, it's been an absolute delight. And are you fulfilling your end of the bargain and going to be bored for a day now?
Oh, yeah, that was my... Yeah, okay. Well, I didn't say a day. I said an hour.
An hour? Yeah. You suck.
So I will pledge... Now that you have joined me on this podcast, I will pledge to set my alarm for an hour and be bored for that hour.
That's no good whatsoever. That's
not... So...
You need to admit to boredom, madam.
By a day, do you mean 24 full hours? Because I'll be asleep for a lot of those.
That's allowed. Boredom does include sleep.
Okay, fine. I'll let you know when I can schedule that in.
Thank you so much.
Where's the best place for people to find you and hear like what you're up to?
Yeah, if you go to offthecurb.co.uk, I'm currently on a UK tour. So if you go to the ENTS24 ticket website and put in my name, you'll get all my dates of my UK tour happening between now and the 16th of December.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This episode was brought to you by Clever Tykes Children's Storybooks. If you want to support the podcast and help share our ethos of inspiring, enterprising behaviour, head over to clevertykes.com and order a set of the storybooks to give to a child that you know.